Good morning. I can tell we're running out of gas.
Good morning, John.
I asked the kids downstairs yesterday to say good afternoon to me with enthusiasm, at least just to make me feel better about it, convince me that there was some energy left. Hosea chapter 4, verse 7. We'll go over a little bit of the material we covered yesterday before we get into our new material today. Speaking of the priests, God had said, "The more they increased, the more they sinned against me." These priests of Israel, the greater they got in number, of course, the greater the sin became, because they really weren't interested in the things of God. God says, "I'm going to change your glory into shame." The great number of priests you have, the fact you're serving at the high places, the religion in which you take your glory, and maybe the power and prestige that comes with it, I'm going to turn it all to shame. It's going to be the reason for your shame. Heads that are high will be hanging low in the future. And we likened it to what Haman experienced in the book of Esther. God said, "They eat up the sin of my people," in verse 8. And we noted that the sin there may also be referring to what? The word sin in verse 8 can also be, yes, referring to the sin offering. That very Hebrew word is translated sin offering some 50 plus times just in Leviticus. I didn't check into the other books. And so you've got kind of a double entendre here, a play on words that you're enjoying the sin of the people. Of course, it puts you in a position where they need you, and you're enjoying eating up the sin offering, of course, because you benefit. Your God is your belly. Philippians chapter 3, verse 19. You're not interested in teaching the people to stray from their sin, because the more they sin, the more sacrifices they bring you, the more for you. You're more than happy to keep the people in a state of guilt, keep people thinking that you're the person they're going to have to turn to far, far more than they really would have to if you would just help them out. So you're going to be rewarded for your works. Verse 10, they shall eat, but not have enough. These priests that love to eat, this is going to be their punishment. They're going to eat, but there's not going to be enough to fill them. These priests who have increased, now are going to try to increase through means of fornication, through harlotry, through perhaps extended concubinage, which wouldn't be right. Or at least was not God's preference. They're going to try to increase the numbers, but it's not going to work. God's going to close the womb. And we talked about how God wants us to view children, that they are a reward, not a penalty like so many people believe today. Verse 11, harlotry wine, new wine, enslave the heart. These are things that are addictive, but they take away the heart, may be the idea really. Your ability to understand and feel and think on a spiritual level has been robbed by your incessant involvement in sin. Sin hardens the heart, as I know you all know. And it makes us incapable of thinking of spiritual things like we ought to. And that was their problem. And as evidence of their foolishness and their lack of understanding, in verse 12, who are they going to for advice? Yeah, going to wooden idols. You go to a piece of wood that you yourself grew the tree, you cut down the tree, you put half of it in the fire and cooked your meal over it, and then you carved the other thing into some kind of image. You've done everything, and then you say, "Oh my God, who saves me?" It's preposterous. Your staff informs you with these methods of divination where they would take the rod and throw it, and depending upon if the bark side came up or the part where the bark was stripped, that would be a yay or a nay. These are the sorts of things they were doing. I mentioned a word yesterday and didn't put it up on the board. Those Babylonian Baru, the men who engaged in things like this, they'd put the oil and the water in the cup and watch the stars and so forth, flights of birds in an attempt to understand what the gods were saying yes or no to. The sorts of things we're talking about here. And what king did we read about who was doing these very things? He talked about how he shakes the arrows. He consults the images. Ezekiel 21:21, Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar would be at the dividing of the roads at a moment of decision, and he himself would turn to divination. You're going up on the high places, on the mountains, on the hills, and you're going where the shade is good. You're choosing your places of worship based on comfort. And furthermore, as Keith pointed out, you may like the idea of shade because it gives you some concealment. You know good and well deep down that what you're doing is wrong. And to do it out in the open may not be very comfortable for you. So you get in a place where you're somewhat concealed. And we may get to that today. That may very much have been at work. So now verse 15. Though you, Israel, play the harlot, let not Judah offend. Do not come up to Gilgal, nor go up to Beth-Aven, nor swear an oath, saying, as the Lord lives. Judah, your northern sister is sinning severely, but don't you learn her ways. I mean, Judah was already on her way, but don't you learn more from her. And in an effort to not do that, don't go up to these two places, to Gilgal, to Beth-Aven. Gilgal, as I suggested yesterday, might be that town that's between Jericho and the Jordan River. It's in which kingdom, the southern kingdom or the northern kingdom? It's in the northern kingdom, just barely. If they have kept the borders that Jeroboam established to the end, to the Dead Sea, then this is in the northern kingdom. But it's on the edge, so it's very accessible to Judah. Now, Gilgal had a wonderful history, as we cited yesterday. But we know from Hosea and Amos, and we keep citing those two because they were temporaries, that it had, contemporaries, that it had become a place, Gilgal, of idolatry. Let's look at a few passages. Hosea chapter 9, verse 15. Hosea 9, verse 15, God makes the statement concerning Gilgal, all their wickedness is in Gilgal. There's idolatry in a big way happening at Gilgal. The place that used to be the holy place where Samuel sacrificed now is a place of wickedness. In chapter 12, verse 11, he cites it again. Though Gilead has idols, surely they are vanity. Though they sacrifice bulls in Gilgal, indeed their altars shall be heaps in the furrows of the field. Wicked sacrificing was going on there. If you flip over to Amos for a moment, Amos says something interesting about their worship in connection with Gilgal. Amos chapter 4, verses 4 and 5. Come to Bethel and transgress. At Gilgal, multiply transgressions. Bring your sacrifices every morning, your tithes every 3 days. Offer a sacrifice of thanksgiving with leaven. Proclaim and announce the freewill offerings. For this you love, you children of Israel, says the Lord God. Notice verse 5. When they're offering a sacrifice of thanksgiving, what are they including in it? Leaven. The law was very clear. Leaven was not to be involved in sacrifice. And when they're offering their free will offerings, what are they doing? Yeah, who's that remind you of? What was it that the Pharisees did? Remember? I mean, they're dropping the money in the treasury, but they're making sure that everyone knows. Everyone paying attention? And that's what the people had become. It's all for show. It's all about me. It's not about the Lord. And you can go up in Gilgal to do it, but Judah don't. I know it's close, but don't do it. Don't go up to Beth-Aven either. Now, when we see the word Beth in the Old Testament, what's it mean?
House, right.
House. But when we see Aven, does anybody know what Aven means?
All right. Wickedness, worthlessness, lots of different ideas.
Vanity, all those things are built into the word. It's also used particularly with respect to the vanity of idols. Now, we do know there was a city called Beth-Aven. It's mentioned in Joshua chapter 7, verse 2. It said that Beth-Aven was on the east side of Bethel. From what I consulted, they were about 6 miles apart. You had Bethel, 6 miles east of Bethel was Beth-Aven. By the way, what's Bethel mean? All right, that's significant. So 6 miles east of the house of God is the house of worthlessness, wickedness, and idolatry. In this case, though, I think what Hosea may mean to imply is not, he's not saying to Judah, don't go up to Beth-Aven, literally. But he's likening Bethel to Beth-Aven. Don't go to Bethel. And I'll give you the reasons why I think that. In Amos chapter 4, verse 4, and Amos 5, 5, in both of those passages, Gilgal and Bethel are mentioned together. They're put in connection with each other. And then in Amos 5, 5, if you want to turn there real quick, notice what he says will happen to Bethel. Amos 5, 5. Do not seek Bethel, nor enter Gilgal, nor pass over to Beersheba, for Gilgal shall surely go into captivity, and Bethel shall come to nothing. And that nothing is Aven. And Amos started his prophecy right at the time or earlier than Hosea. I think Hosea may be referencing this thing. Bethaven's close to Bethel, but the point being, Bethel, the house of God, has become Bethaven, a house of wickedness, a house of worthlessness. That's what it has to look forward to. That's what it is. Judah, don't go there. It's not the house of God anymore. It's a house of idolatry. It's down south too. Both of these cities are close. Judah would just have to walk over the border, which you could do, and go participate and go home. But he says, don't you do it. Nor swear an oath, saying, as the Lord lives. Now, what do we do with that? This was the Lord's formula. Deuteronomy 6:13, Deuteronomy 10:20. God had said, swear in my name. And we know that meant as the Lord lives. So when a Jew said, as the Lord lives, thus and so will happen, or I will do, that was in harmony with God's will. So why is he saying, don't do it here? Yeah, you've got no business calling the Lord's name in an oath if you're going to follow after idolatry. And there's a lesson there for us, you know. If we're going to bring the Lord's name into our conversation and bring the Lord's name into our lives and act as if we are the Lord's, we'd better make sure that we are. We don't want to be guilty of the same sort of thing. Don't swear in God's name while practicing idolatry. Did you have a comment, Keith?
I was just thinking, going back to Jeroboam, you have to say, he said, this be the God that brought you out.
Okay, and the connection.
So they're misidentifying. And when you look at chapter 10, verse 5, that connection between Bethel and Bethaven is made very clear.
Okay. It was just said, wouldn't, go ahead and say it into the mic. Go ahead. He's got it for you. I insist.
I just said, wouldn't this break the commandment, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain?
I must, because God's telling them not to do it. Don't follow after Israel's ways, because after all, verse 16, Israel's stubborn. Like a stubborn calf, now the Lord will let them forage like a lamb in open country. My New King James says calf, but just about every other translation, what's your translation say?
Heifer.
And that is what it is. I looked the word up. That's definitely what we're dealing with. I don't know why my New King James translators made the decision that they did. For us city folks, what's a heifer? It's a female, and it's not just a female, right? It's never calved. Now, as I understand it, at least in American parlance, it used to be 3 years or younger, something like that. I don't know if that's built in to the Hebrew word here. But we've got a young female cow, and I know that's redundant, that has not calved. Now, Israel, he says, is like a heifer. You remember what Samson said to those Philistines? Yes, it's not a very flattering phrase. They had figured out the meaning to his riddle, but not through ingenuity. They'd gotten it out of his wife. And he told him in Judges 14:18, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle. Now, he may be referring there to infidelity on the part of these men and on her part. It's not, but the idea is here, she's this woman, and you've been consorting with her on some level. Well, Israel's the same way. Israel's not been any more faithful to God than she had been to Samson. And what's more, she's stubborn. What was it that God said about the nation of Israel? They are a stiff-necked people. And of course, that relates to this idea of a yoke. You ought to be able, as the master of an animal, to come with the yoke, place it on the neck of that beast, and count on her or him pulling the load. But Israel wouldn't do it. We're not going to pull the burden that God has for us. I will not serve the Lord, even though his yoke was easy and his burden light. She is a stubborn heifer. So what's the Lord going to do? Well, now the Lord will let her forage like a lamb in open country. And we got another translation issue here. I've encountered them all over. We may encounter more of these in the Old Testament than we do in the New. If you're reading out of the King James or the New King James, or even if you have a Young's Literal translation there, it reads like what I just said, a statement. God is going to let this stubborn heifer go and forage in open country like a lamb. However, if you're reading out of the NAS, the ESV, or the NIV, it's a question. Would someone with the NIV read that out loud for us? Okay, how then can he do this? So We've got a statement versus a question. I don't know exactly which one it's supposed to be, but it certainly affects the meaning. If it is a statement, if God is saying we have a stubborn heifer here who will not pull her load, she's refused to submit to me, I'm going to send her out in open pasture as a lamb. Now, lambs like open pasture, from what I read. But is a lamb in safe circumstances an open pasture? No. A lamb is defenseless, as you well know. And being out in open pasture, the lamb's going to love it because, after all, there are no limits, no boundaries. Here's a people that has said, let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us. They break all restraint, he said, in the fourth chapter, the second verse. They don't want my law, so I'm going to give them. Go, fine, go. You don't have to worry about my laws anymore. But remember, in so doing, you're going to be defenseless. That would be the idea if he's talking about, if he's making a statement here. The Assyrian attack and captivity is coming, and you're not going to be able to do anything about it. If, however, it's a question, then I think the idea is, you've been like this, Israel. You've been stubborn. How then can I bless you? By giving you what a lamb would want, what a lamb would desire. How can I give you what you want when you won't give me what you must? So, we move to verse 17 then.
John?
Yes. Question. You want to wait for the microphone? Do you mind? It's coming.
I understood what you said there, but it uses the term, at least in what I have here, now the Lord will feed. Now, in the word feed would indicate a type of a care to this. And you're indicating that they're going to just let them out in an open area just to kind of fend for themselves.
And that, so how does your King James read? Would you read that to us?
Yes, said, and for Israel slideth back as a backsliding heifer. Now the Lord will feed them as a lamb in a large place.
Wow, there's another difference. Mine says the Lord will let them forage. So yours makes it active on God's part, whereas mine is saying he's going to let them do it.
Go back to the context of Hosea and his wife. It helps to clarify.
Here's the mic.
If we go back to the basic premise of the book, which gives us the relationship between God and Israel is the same as the relationship between Hosea and Gomer. I think it clarifies. Hosea, God wants to take care of them, but stubbornly they will not. They have refused his every effort to care for them. He wants to put them in, he promised them the land of Canaan. But they stubbornly refused to take it, even though it was their inheritance. And it just went downhill from there. That very much mirrors the relationship that between Hosea and Gomer. Because Hosea wanted her to be a wife to him. But as try as he might, she kept her dalliances outside their relationship. So this idea of feeding, pasturing, caring for, God wants to fulfill that role just as Hosea does.
Okay. So if the Lord intended it as a question, and if he meant feed in an active sense on his part, then what Keith said certainly would fit. I feel like it's hard for me to come down real on a hard line on some of these translation issues. These translators know way more than I do, and we've got intellectuals on both sides, and they're making different decisions. But I can see that point, if that's how we're to understand it.
Not to throw too much of a wrench into it, but up to chapter 4, that would make sense. But it seems in chapter 4, God has said, the time for repentance is over. Judgment is now coming upon my people. So it seems like that, yes, up to this point, God wants to care for Israel. But from the context of everything that you said, God's going to bring a judgment upon them, and it's destruction. And it seems like the chance is for reconciliation is now over.
I think he's going to make that clear later on, that they are never going to turn back to him now. They are so deep-seated in this idolatry, I think, as we're going to see, that there's no hope of them coming back to him. So in light of that, the punishment is certain. Yeah. Bill's got a comment. Oh, Ray.
My center reference says open country. The lamb's going to be released in open country. God's not going to take care of him anymore.
That's one way of understanding it.
Verse 17, in connection with Romans 1:24, seems to be the thought that God would give up on him.
Okay. Let's move on. I'm afraid that we're probably not going to resolve this in everyone's mind. I encourage you just to do some more study. Verse 17, Ephraim is joined to idols. Let him alone. Now, when you read joined to idols, does that make you think of anything? What should Ephraim be joined to, or who? Yeah, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave or be joined to his wife. She ought to be joined to her husband, the Lord, but she has instead chosen to be joined to her lovers, whom she has become one body with. For you become one flesh and one body with a harlot. So says Paul in 1 Corinthians 6. In Numbers 25, verse 3, it said that Israel was joined to Baal of Peor. Remember, in the days of Balaam. Hosea 9:10 is interesting in that it says, when she was joined to Baal of Peor, I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your fathers as the first fruits on the fig tree in its first season. But they went to Baal of Peor and separated themselves to that shame. And I just think this language is interesting. Where God has called us to be separated from the world and joined to him, Israel's got this completely backwards. They have joined themselves to idols and separated themselves from God. They've completely put it upside down. So God says, let him alone. Let him rest. Let him rest from your admonitions, from your rebukes, from your contending, just like he said in chapter 4, verse 4, let no man contend or rebuke another. Give him rest from it. It's not going to do him any good anyway. He doesn't want it. Let him have his rest, his temporary rest. Just throw one passage out. In Zechariah chapter 11, verses 7 through 9, there's a very involved prophecy concerning Jesus. And in verse 9, in prophetic speech here, Jesus says of the Pharisees and people like them, I will not feed you. Let what is dying die, and what is perishing perish. Eventually, this was the Lord's attitude towards these men. Scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, fine. You can have what you want. They have their reward. And that's the same attitude the Lord is expressing here. Their drink, verse 18, is rebellion. They commit harlotry continually. They drink it like their wine. They love their wine. They love to get drunk on their wine. They're always thirsty for it. So is rebellion to them. They drink it like water, Job 15:16, as if they needed it. And we know how God views rebellion. Rebellion is as the sin of what? Witchcraft. We have your question how God feels about that. 1 Samuel 15:23. I do know, though, even as I express that passage, that some of you are looking at a translation which says something quite different. Would someone read to us what the King James says in verse 18, the first phrase? Their drink is sour. Their drink is sour. The NIV, how does it render the first part of 18? Their drink is gone. Their drink is sour. The word rendered rebellion in my translation, sour and gone in yours, is used in Ezekiel 18, verse 2, and is translated there, sour. The parents have eaten sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge. However, that appears to be the only, maybe one of the only places where that translation is appropriate. The word can mean to turn off, literally or figuratively. I think the idea is probably this. Their wine is no longer good to drink. Either it is gone or it is sour, but it's no longer something they want. They love to drink wine, but when it's all gone or it's no good to drink, what have they turned to? They commit harlotry. And what did he said? Wine, harlotry, wine, and new wine. This is what they're about. Their life has become about excess. This is a pagan culture. In worship, as well as maybe in life, it's all about wine and fornication. When their liquor is gone, says the NAS, they play the harlot continually. And look what it says about her rulers. Her rulers dearly love dishonor. I remember a man saying to me, and some of you have heard me mention this, when I was in college, I was working this delivery job, and there was a guy I worked with, And he had a level of faith. He was not a Christian, did not regard himself as such. And he told me once, he said, I know I need to become a Christian, but he knew if he became a Christian, he'd have to give up the marijuana and he'd have to give up his promiscuous lifestyle. And he was not willing to do that. Sin had become dear to him, dear enough to risk his soul. And that's the kind of people Hosea is talking about here. Her rulers are this kind of people. They love their sin, their wickedness. The thing that really is their dishonor, they love it. They don't want to let go of it. So, verse 19, here's this Middle East, these metaphors, these expressions they use. The wind has wrapped her up in its wings. The wind has wrapped her up in its wings. Like a tornado, like a hurricane. I've been able to spend some time in Florida over the past couple of years, and this is something these people deal with on a somewhat regular basis. I mean, when the hurricane's coming in, you know, we're seeing all this stuff on the news, and it seems like it would just be a huge deal to us. And it is a big deal, but the church just goes over to one of the brothers' houses. It's a metal house. They get in, they shut the door, and they ride it out. And they've done this maybe more than once. They've talked about what it's like when the eye of the storm is just, you know, it's this amazing calm when the storm hits. Now, when the storm hits, is there any fighting it? Of course not. Not at all. And we are shown just how weak we are and insignificant at that moment. And Israel, that's what it's like for you. The tornado, the hurricane has swept you up. You're not going to stop your punishment. There's no stopping it. There's no running away from it. It's going to carry you to the day of your doom, and it's going to drop you where it wants to. Your destruction is sure. They shall be ashamed because of their sacrifices. We're ready for chapter 5. Hear this, O priests. Take heed, O house of Israel. So notice the change. Chapter 4, verse 1, he addresses it to the children of Israel. Now we've got a change. It happens to work well with the chapter break this time. He's addressing them specifically. Hear this, O priests. Take heed, O house of Israel. Give ear, O house of the king, for yours is the judgment, because you have been a snare to Mizpah and a net sprayed on Tabor, to the princes, the people, and the priests alike. And notice, the people are flanked on either side by their civil leaders, by their spiritual leaders. When Haggai started to preach to the people to build the temple, Haggai 1:1, he starts with the leaders. He started with Zerubbabel, who was the governor, with Joshua, who was the high priest. It was to the leaders first that he addressed the message. And interestingly, when they finally do start building the temple, if you read it, it's the leaders who are mentioned first. If good's going to happen in a congregation, it's got to start with the leaders. You know, and if a congregation isn't what it ought to be, there's a place to look to the leaders. So, to the leaders and the people alike, yours is the judgment. How are we to understand that? What's the point? When he says yours is the judgment, what's he saying? You're guilty. The judgment is for you. It applies to you. And here's why. You've been a snare to Mizpah and a net spread on Tabor. Now, when you hear the words net and snare, what do you think of? Trapping, hunting. This is trapping and hunting terminology. Like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare, says Ecclesiastes 9, verse 12. Who are the hunters? The leaders. The leaders are the hunters, and the people are the hunted. The leaders have designs on the people. Jeroboam wanted to keep his kingdom. He wanted the people to serve him. So what's he do? He starts idolatry. And the people, like a foolish bird or a fish with no sense who bites the hook, they're walking right into the traps. Over here in Mizpah, which is on the east side of the Jordan, over in Tabor, Mount Tabor, which is on the west side of the Jordan, east and west, apparently idolatry was being used to draw the people, to ensnare them and entangle them. And this, I think this is meaningful. The leaders intentionally led the people into these things for their own purposes. From Dan to Bethel, from Mizpah to Tabor, north, south, east, and west, the rulers were keeping the idolatry going to keep the people ensnared right where they wanted them. Verse 2, the revolters are deeply involved in slaughter, though I rebuke them all. I know, Ephraim, and Israel is not hidden from me. For now, O Ephraim, you commit harlotry. Israel is defiled. the revolters, these rebellious souls, they're deeply involved. They're not dabbling. They're in deep. And they're in deep in slaughter. Well, what kind of slaughter are we talking about? Well, chapter 4, verse 2, what was going on in Israel again? Killing. Killing. Murdering. Yes, this may have some relevance for the sacrifices that were going on in the idol temples, in the idol high places, but there was killing and murdering going on. A wicked people gets violent. And furthermore, what was this wickedness going to get them? More slaughter. There was slaughter on the horizon. Bloodshed upon bloodshed. And very possibly the leaders were in the business of killing people. Why would the leaders find it necessary to murder people? Get rid of dissension. You know, there are a handful of righteous people in this place. And here you are, you're trying to make Tabor or Mizpah, or you're trying to keep idolatry going in one of these places, just like Antiochus Epiphanes wanted there to be idolatry in the cities of Judah. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with the history of the Maccabees, but Judas Maccabees' father, when he saw them trying to make the Jews sacrifice to idols, does anybody remember what he did? This is history from 1 Maccabees. He rose up and he killed that man who was going to offer that sacrifice. Zeal for the Lord's house had eaten him up. And it started a movement which finally threw idolatry out of Israel for good. The righteous can stand in the way of the wicked. And the wicked have no compunction about ending the life of the righteous. There was slaughter and bloodshed in Israel. I know Ephraim, he says. Israel's not hidden from me. The eyes of the Lord are in every place, keeping watch on the evil and on the good. I would like to go over to Ezekiel 8 to notice something. You know, God's saying to them, you're not hidden from me. And you'd think to yourself, well, what do they think they're hidden from God? No one would possibly think that, would they? Ezekiel 8's interesting in light of that. In Ezekiel 8, God is showing Ezekiel through vision the idolatry that's taking place in the temple and in the area around the temple. And keep in mind that this is a vision. But in verse 6, God speaking to Ezekiel, he said to me, Son of man, do you see what they are doing? The great abominations that the house of Israel commits here to make me go far away from my sanctuary? Now turn again, you will see greater abominations. So he brought me to the door of the court. And when I looked, there was a hole in the wall. Then he said to me, Son of man, dig into the wall. And when I dug into the wall, there was a door. So here's this hidden door. And he said to me, go in and see the wicked abominations which they are doing there. So I went in and saw, and there, every sort of creeping thing, abominable beasts, and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed all around the walls. This is a place of idolatry. And there stood before them 70 men of the elders of the house of Israel. And in their midst stood Jaazaniah, the son of Shaphan. Each man had a censer in his hand, and a thick cloud of incense went up. Do you get the picture? Here's the secret place, the secret door. You had to dig to even find it. You go down, and here are these 70 elders of Israel, the men who ought to be leading the people in righteousness. Here they are in this secret place, holding these censers, worshiping the idols. And notice what God says in verse 12. He said to me, Son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel do in the dark? Every man in the room of his idols? For they say, the Lord does not see us. The Lord has forsaken the land. God's not around here anymore. Jehovah used to be our God, but he's gone. He's not paying any attention. So we're in this secret place where people don't see us. God's not seeing us either. God says in Hosea 5:3, I see you. I've been watching all along. I haven't departed the land. Ephraim, he says, you commit idolatry. Why would he single out Ephraim as the ones committing the idolatry? Clearly, they're not the only ones. Isn't it a symbol? Well, it may be a symbol. It may just be a reference to the nation. I think there might be more to it than that. Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, was from Ephraim. 1 Kings 11:26. And furthermore, Bethel, the king's sanctuary, the royal religious center, it's in Ephraim. Ephraim was the hotbed. It was the worst. And from it had gone out this polluting influence which had defiled the whole nation. Now he does separate Ephraim and Israel. And I had mentioned earlier last week, and you heard a whole bunch about it in the previous class. You have this, there are these potential of co-regencies. And also in a kingdom that's falling apart like Israel, there is the potential that there were some rival rulers, that there at the end maybe Pekah was reigning even while Menahem and Pekahiah were in Samaria, that there was actually some rivalry going on. And it could be that the separation indicates that, but I would never say that with certainty, and I don't think it's necessary for understanding the text. Israel is defiled. Verse 4. They do not direct their deeds. Notice the emphasis on deeds again. They do not direct their deeds toward turning to their God, and here's why. For the spirit of harlotry is in their midst, and they do not know the Lord. One more translation thing. My New King James reads, as you heard, they do not direct their deeds toward turning to their God, for the spirit of harlotry is in their midst. Notice the difference, if you notice it here, in the American Standard reads, their doings will not suffer them to turn unto their God. The NAS, their deeds will not allow them to turn to their God. The ESV, their deeds do not permit them to return to their God. I didn't look at the NIV, but my guess is it goes right along that idea. In other words, and I think it may be there in the New King James, which is just not as easy to see, that their deeds, their lifestyle, had come to the point where they couldn't even see past it to make the change. Idolatry was firmly embedded in Israel's social, its political, its religious life. The farming that they did even was connected to idol worship. When it came time to go out planting, maybe you went to the high place first to seek Baal so that he would bless your field. Every facet of life was connected to it. Most of these children had been raised as idolaters. It's not like they were raised with the truth, and then when they're 10 or 15 or 20 years old, they made a decision to follow after Baal. They'd been raised up with it. How often do people leave what they were raised with? Whenever you ask people, where do you go to church? And they say thus and so. And maybe you ask them, oh, what made you choose that church? What's the answer? That's where my mom and dad went. Or that's where my family went. And people feel like that's perfectly normal. That's perfectly normal to them. Well, yeah, I chose it because that's family. The zeitgeist, the spirit of the age, was the spirit of idolatry. Chapter 2, verse 6, remember what he said. God said, I will hedge up your way with thorns. I will wall her in so that she cannot find her what? Her paths. These were her habits. This was life. She was always going to the Baals, always going to the idols. There were these well-worn paths. And what had it finally done? The addiction to sin, the living with sin, the normality of that had finally brought them to a point where the spirit of harlotry ruled them. There was not going to be any turning back. The Bible teaches us this can happen. I suppose you looked at it in Hebrews 3. Hebrews 3:13, what can harden us? He says, do not be hardened by what? The deceitfulness of sin. Sin can get its hooks in you to the point where you're beyond. You're hardened. 1 Timothy 4:2, Paul talks about those whose consciences are seared with a hot iron. They lie, they speak lies in hypocrisy. They know what they're teaching is false, but they do it anyway because they are beyond the point of feeling. They don't care anymore. Ephesians 4:19. I don't completely grasp what that's like, and I don't want to, but I always wonder about these sorts of things. When you have people who know the truth and live their lives against it, you know, as they're approaching death, I mean, what sort of things do they think about? Do they try to convince themselves that, yeah, maybe, I don't understand it. But the Bible assures me that people can get to that point, and we need to take it to heart. Don't let sin get a foothold in your life. Gary?
I think that's why they turn to drink. That clutters their mind.
Oh. They feel good. Good point. That's why they turn to drink, he said. It clutters their mind. It makes them feel good. I think there's a lot of that. That's one of the appeals of a lot of the activity that surrounds us. I think that's partly maybe why people like distraction so much. You know, you get by yourself, and it's just you. And if you don't like you, or if you know you're on the wrong path, it's not very fun to be with you. So you do everything you can to get away from you. And I imagine some of us here have had moments like that, where in a low moment in a spiritual life, we ourselves became like that. Now, That's the time to start listening and make the change. But there are going to be those who aren't going to want to. They do not know the Lord. Chapter 4, verse 1, there's no knowledge of God in the land. Chapter 4, verse 6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Again, Hosea comes back to this. They do not know the Lord. They know of the Lord, but they don't know the Lord. I don't know how many of you know Chris Valdivieso. He's a member of the congregation at Blue Springs. He gave a sermon from this pulpit a couple of years ago on a Sunday night. And he said something, I'd heard him say it before, but I think it's a very memorable and meaningful point. He did not grow up in the church. He grew up in an environment where he was taken to lots of different denominations and so forth so that he could get a flavor, a taste of all of them, so that he could make his own decision. He encountered the Lord's church when he was 19 and became a Christian then. And he made the statement here. He said, a lot of people have heard of the church, but very few people have seen the church. You know, the concept of the church, it's out there. People talk about it all the time. But how many people have really seen the true church? Very few. And in the same way, these were people who were familiar with the name of Jehovah, the name Yahweh. They knew about Him, but they didn't really know anything. They didn't know Him. Not at all. Verse 5, the pride of Israel testifies to His face. Therefore Israel and Ephraim stumble in their iniquity. Judah also stumbles with him. And we talked about that last week. With all these military victories they'd had under Jeroboam, with all the money that had flowed in as a result of it, with their mansions and their houses of ivory, and probably their rising star among the nations, they'd become very self-reliant. I mean, things have gone great for us without God. Who needs God? But he says their pride testifies to their face. That's an interesting statement. Israel's pride, he doesn't say testifies to me. He says Israel's pride testifies to his own face. What does he mean by that? Well, the houses they built, it's not wrong to have nice places, but these were built probably in relationship to pride, many of them. Your own home, your own opulence, unnecessary opulence, it testifies to you what you're really about. But Paul tells us that our spirit declares to us who we really are. 1 Corinthians 2, verse 11, for what man knows the things of a man except the spirit of a man which is in him? Romans 8, 16, the Spirit Himself bears witness with our spirit, not to our spirit, with our spirit, that we are children of God. In other words, you have a spirit. That spirit is who you are, and it knows you. Deep down in our heart of hearts, our spirit, they're not the same thing, but we use that other expression. Our spirit knows who we really are. And that's why Paul tells us to examine ourselves. He says in 2 Corinthians 13, 5, do you not know yourselves? You know yourselves if you'll be honest. If Israel would have been honest and stopped drinking all the time and playing the harlot and doing all these other things and just stopped and listened and looked at his own life, he would have seen it. But Israel doesn't. Therefore, they stumble in their iniquity, and Judah stumbles with them. Notice verse 6. With their flocks and herds, they shall go to seek the Lord, but they will not find Him. He has withdrawn Himself from them. This is interesting. This is a people who doesn't know the Lord, who haven't paid attention to the Lord's ways, but apparently all this talk from Hosea and other prophets was eventually going to stir them a little bit. People were going to start getting scared. And as a result, they're going to take their flocks and herds, they're going to take their animals to sacrifice to God. But what does God say? I'm not going to respond. You're not going to find me. Now why? I mean, this is the whole premise that if you'll just turn to me, but now they're bringing sacrifices and he's hiding from them. What's going on? They're bringing their animals, but they're not bringing their hearts. Oh, well, we better make some sacrifices here so maybe God won't do this, or at least we can break the fall a little bit. But it's completely self-serving. This isn't about coming to the Lord with the kind of life He requires. Maybe if we just give Him a sacrifice, He'll give us something. Maybe if I put enough money in the plate, I can buy my way into heaven. That's the mentality. Isaiah goes on about this. Isaiah chapter 1, verses 11 through 17. He talks about their insincerity. You're bringing sacrifices, but you're not changing your life. And to obey is better than sacrifice. When you spread out your hands, Isaiah 1:15, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. I'm not going to hear your words because of what your hands are doing. It's time for your 15 minutes. Does anyone have any comments or questions?
Do you remember what the Lord said? Many shall say to me in that day, this and that and the other.
Yes.
And he did not have done all of what they claimed. But what did he tell them?
That's right. Depart from me, you workers of iniquity. I never knew you.
Never knew you.
Yes. And that is an important passage there in Matthew. We can do a lot of things in the name of the Lord, but unless we're really doing them for the Lord, they're not going to get us anywhere. Tim's got a comment, and then we'll hear from Keith.
Isn't addiction like being completely out of control, especially when you don't do anything about it?
Yes. And sin is addictive. I mean, it's the law of diminishing returns. You know, the first shot of the first pill does quite a bit, but then you need it more over time, and sin's the same way. And like someone once said, the chains of sin are too light to be felt until they're so strong we can hardly break them, because it just gradually inches in into our lives.
And what about addiction, where we get in kind of a depressed stupor and deny that we need counseling and those kinds of things or something? Or don't heed the admonition of the elders or leadership or older people or whoever it might be?
Well, that's a loaded question. I think there are a lot of factors that go into that. We need to heed the advice of our elders, no question. If our elders say for us to do something that's in harmony with the will of God, we need to obey it. No question. Depression is a slippery eel for me. I am no expert, and I hesitate really to say anything, so maybe I shouldn't. But I'm not sure that counseling, so-called, is the answer all the time. Sometimes I think depression, sometimes at least, is really just deep down. We've not done what we need to do. Deep down, there's been a lack of admitting to ourselves that we're withholding from God, or we're very angry at God, or we're angry at somebody else, and we're trying to suppress that. We're trying to pretend it's not there, and the natural result is depression. And sometimes we just need to face up and fess up. There may be other times, though. I'm not going to deny there are chemical things that can go on that we may need help with. But
On the last point you made in chapter 5, verse 6, there's an interesting passage that is even more condemning in the prophet Malachi.
Okay.
In Malachi chapter 1 and verse 10, where it reads, "Oh, that one of you would shut the temple doors, so that you would not light useless fires on my altar. I am not pleased with you, says the Lord Almighty, and I will accept no offering from your hand."
Yeah.
Now that was written directly to the priests. Interesting condemnation.
Yeah.
Rather than do what you're doing, I wish one of you had the courage and the faithfulness to just shut the doors.
Your sacrifices weary me is the idea. Dennis Hedda, do we have someone back there?
At the end of chapter 4, you address the comment, rulers dearly love, their rulers dearly love shameful ways.
Yes.
Would you equate that even a step back, that rulers may not love, but rulers who overlook, or rulers who by their inaction condone shameful ways, does this apply, that they may not love them, but they overlook them?
Oh, well, yeah, I think that might qualify, because they overlook them because, there may be various reasons. I don't know if you're thinking in terms of the church, maybe. Yeah, there is some of that going on in the church, where elders overlook sin in the camp because they don't want to deal with it. I have been disturbed, and we've been hitting on the subject of modesty a lot over the past 5 or 6 years, and we went a long time without talking a whole lot about it, and then the problem just seemed so blatant, we all just started hitting it all at once, it kind of feels like. I've talked about it, I've been asked to talk about it, and I know you heard some about it this week and so forth, so I'm not going to beat you with that anymore. But I will say, when I first started talking about that subject, and please do not think this is self-aggrandizement, that's not it at all, I didn't really consider it that huge of a deal. I knew I might upset some people, but when I talked about it, I have gotten the impression from some that, well, I had one man tell me, and he was an officer in the church, he just seemed almost amazed that I had the guts to talk about it. I find that very disturbing. I hope our leaders are not, well, we just need to make sure if we are in a leadership position that we take the action we need to when there are things done. If that means, and I, you know, I've never had this experience, but I know this is right in the Lord's way. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. If it means that your child's going to have to be withdrawn from, I hope you will love the Lord more than that child. It's terrible to the camp of the saints when we overlook sin, when it has come to a point where it's got to be dealt with. And yeah, I guess you could make the argument that that, in a sense, is loving that, because you'd rather see it continue than make the hard decisions. Doug had a comment.
I was just thinking about the fact that sometimes all of us, but especially leadership within the church, really can love the praise of men more than the praise of God.
That's easy to do. That's easy to do. Yeah. Were there any other comments? We've got one down here, Dwayne.
We were talking earlier about the verse 16 in the chapter 4 when, and how it's translated in the NIV about the lamb, or the, how can the lamb, the Lord, pasture them like lambs in a meadow. And I couldn't stop thinking about this after we talked about it. And Jesus talked about the shepherd, and he was the good shepherd, and the sheep hear his voice. Mm-hmm. And I think he used that metaphor because when the sheep are in the pasture, they are with a shepherd. And in this case, it's the sheep rejecting the shepherd, which is unusual for sheep who are used to that shepherd.
Interesting.
So it seems like it fits perfectly with here. And I was even wondering if perhaps this is a messianic because it ties in with the 53rd chapter of Isaiah, how the sheep were scattered, gone astray. I don't know.
Well, an interesting thought. That is an interesting picture, as if the shepherd has them all in his fold and he just opens the gate and lets them out. That's where you want to go, so you can go. Mark?
I was thinking the same thing about that, and I was thinking of the fact that of an animal such as a lamb is very vulnerable. And in a large place, I was thinking of a lamb out in the middle of an open area such as their area. Some of their areas are very desert. There wouldn't be much to eat. And I also thought of the scripture where the Lord said he lets the rain fall on the just and the unjust.
Yes.
So in a sense, the Lord's going to still take care of them, but they're going to be hard-pressed to find much.
And we should remember also that there are no lions in Israel today, but there were at this time. It's discussed with some frequency. In fact, the Lord's going to use that metaphor. So a sheep out there is just waiting to be consumed. Tim?
About this business of leadership, God will use a leader even if it's a child. Think of how kings in Israel and Judah God used when they were really not much more than a child or thereabouts. He'll use whoever. You know, where there's no leadership, the congregations just begin to fade away. You know, make a comment about that.
Well, when I think of Joash, for example, I mean, he certainly had advisors till he came of age. Children can be wonderful examples for us. I don't know that I would call them leaders in the biblical sense, but I think of the statement that prophets that where there is no vision, the people perish. And one of the jobs of a leader is to have a course for the congregation. You know, any leader, if a business leader, not that I've ever been one, but we've got some here, I imagine, they could comment on this. If there's no plan for the future, if there's no goals in mind, you can expect to fail. I mean, if you shoot for nothing, you're sure to hit it. And there is, in my opinion, too much of that in the Lord's church, at least here in America. Mike?
I appreciate Keith's comments regarding the book of Malachi. And continuing in the second chapter, he hits it again, talking in the 14th verse about them weeping and wailing because the Lord is no longer paying attention to their offerings. And that's the predecessor to the verse that we often quote about, I hate divorce, because that's how he opens it up. The people complaining about how that the Lord isn't accepting their sacrifices, and he's saying it's because of the relationships that you're having, the illegitimate, the inappropriate relationships that you're having with one another. And so this seems to me to tie it all right back again to some of the things that we're seeing in the book of Hosea, tying in the relationship of Gomer and Hosea with the Lord and his mm-hmm. people.
Interesting thoughts. Anything else? We've got one more up here. No, I don't mind.
I just wanted to reinforce something you mentioned almost in passing from chapter 5, verse 1, when you talked about the priests and the royal house being in flanking positions. That is even starts up in verse 18 when the phrase, their rulers, literally means their shields, their protectors. And when you link that with what Duane was saying earlier about the shepherd, it's interesting to see that idea, that concept being developed. And I suspect if we go further back, we would find that concept being carried forward much earlier in Hosea, mm-hmm. and I know it carries forward much later in Hosea.
You know, I remember one brother saying to me years ago, he says, you're going to find out just how much like sheep God's people really are. And that wasn't an insult. It was just a statement of fact, because people are people. The Lord likens us to sheep because that's how we are. And in a flock of sheep, you may have, I don't know how big a fold can get with only one shepherd, but say 25, 50 sheep, there's one shepherd. I find that interesting. You know, apparently, in a body of people, and it's always been this way, most are sheep-like, and there are only a few that are qualified to be shepherds of the sheep. Now, it doesn't mean those shepherds aren't sheep themselves, but most of us are just plain followers. It's groupthink. If the group goes this way, we go this way. If the group goes this way, we go this way. And that's why the shepherds are so important, because if the shepherds will just direct the group will go. Now, I realize some of you who've been elders for years, you might say, well, that's a nice ideal, John. It doesn't always work that way, but there must be some truth to it, or the Bible wouldn't use that picture. Let me remark just a little bit here on verse 7. We might pick up with it a little bit more tomorrow. I guess my plan is at this point to spend a little more time in chapter 5 in the morning, and then, as I said, we will go over to a chapter 11 and notice some of the things there. Chapter 5, verse 7, they have dealt treacherously with the Lord, and here's what they've done to do it. They have begotten pagan children. Now a new moon shall devour them and their heritage. Malachi, which has been cited a couple of times already, chapter 2, verse 11, God says, Judah has dealt treacherously, same word, and an abomination has been committed in Israel and in Jerusalem, for Judah has profaned the Lord's holy institution which he loves. Now let me stop there. Judah has dealt treacherously. He has profaned the Lord's holy institution. Does anyone remember how the verse finishes out? What has he done to deal treacherously? How has he profaned God's holy institution? Malachi 2, verse 11, he has married the daughter of a foreign god. He's married a pagan. So you deal treacherously right out of the gate, at least in the case of Israel. They were dealing treacherously right from the beginning in marrying someone who was not an Israelite by faith. Not necessarily by blood, but by faith. And if you marry a pagan, what kind of children can you expect to bear? It's very possible you're going to bear pagan children. And of course, if both parents are pagan, then you can be guaranteed. And I do think there's a New Testament application here, and I know you talked about that last week, so I won't hit it too hard here, but 2 Corinthians 6, 14 through 17, which we're always citing, what part has a believer with an unbeliever? Sure, you're going to work with people who are outside the faith. Sure, you're going to interact with them in the neighborhood and so forth. You need to. You'll never bring the light to them if you don't. But when it comes to marriage, the closest union we have here on this face of the earth, the person with whom you're going to become one flesh and raise up offspring, who are you going to unite yourself to? The Lord wants a widow to marry in the Lord. Now, if he wants a widow to marry in the Lord, how does he want the single person who's never been married to marry? Stands to reason he wants her to marry in the Lord too. Our time's up, so Lord willing, we'll continue tomorrow. Thank you for your attention.